Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does your life affect the people around you? Not just those you know as friends and family, but those you interact with in business, travel alongside in your commute, and share public facilities and infrastructure with. Can you minimize the resources you use and maximize the contributions you make to the world without living like a Spartan? And should you consider that your responsibility? Bill McKibben is here to talk about some of those questions. He's an environmentalist and the author of a dozen books, including Deep Economy, The End of Nature, Maybe One, and The Bill McKibben Reader. He is in town to speak at the EPA's National Sustainable Communities Training Conference. Bill, welcome back to Think.
It's so good to be here, Chris.
Let's start with the concept that you've written a lot about in the past, which is the deep economy. Mm-hmm. This is basically the real-life economy that we experience on a personal level.
That's right. And we've gotten, in the last 50 years, away from that economy in our lives. As things have globalized relentlessly, the number of things that we actually do in our communities or in our own lives is getting smaller and smaller all the time. You know, the average bite of food that you eat has traveled 2,000 miles to reach your lips. And we were able to get away with that for a while, but we're not going to be able to get away with it much longer. The environmental toll of doing that is becoming unbearable, global warming being the great example. The cheap energy that underwrote it is increasingly drying up, and we're realizing the great toll that it took on our communities. You know, the average American in the sprawling economy that we've built, highly individualized economy, the average American has half as many close friends as somebody 50 years ago. That's a big change. There's not enough iPods in the world to make up for having half as many people that you're really connected with.
Do you think that's what happened, that we lost sight of that because we were acquiring more things?
It was almost physical. I mean, think what the American project has been since the end of World War II. It's basically been building bigger houses farther apart from each other. Okay, that's what we've been about. That's how we defined the American dream. Well, it meant that even within our own homes, we saw far less of each other. The average family eats meals half as often together as they did 50 years ago. We talk a lot about family values, but we don't really have families anymore in quite the same way. And it meant we were deeply disconnected from everyone around us, you know, just because we were spending all our time driving back and forth. And how would you? You know, if you live on your own half acre, the odds that you'll know, 3/4 of Americans don't know their next door neighbor. They may, you know their name, but they have no relationship to them. That's a very new condition for a primate to find itself in, you know, and it's no wonder that the number of Americans who say that they're very happy with their lives peaked in 1956 and has gone steadily downhill ever since.
So what starts to change when we focus, at least economic activity, on locally owned businesses?
Okay, let's take an example. You've been to the farmer's market, doubtless, all right?
We have a beautiful one here.
Farmer's markets are the fastest growing part of the food economy in this country. Sales have been growing 15% a year. They're doubling in number every few years. It's very good. Very good ecologically, because it takes a lot less energy to grow food and, you know, distribute it 5 miles, not 5,000 miles, okay? And probably better tasting, too. I mean, I traveled 2,000 miles to get to Dallas today. I know how I feel. That's pretty much how the tomato feels, too, when it arrives, you know? But the best part is that it's better for you in a kind of relationship way. A pair of sociologists a few years ago followed shoppers, first around the supermarket, then around the farmer's market. Now, you've been to the supermarket. You know how that works. You walk in. You fall into a kind of light fluorescent trance. You visit the stations of the cross around the supermarket. You emerge somehow with basically the same basket of stuff you had the week before. Maybe you discuss paper or plastic, you know, with the cashier. That's about it. When they followed people around the farmer's market, they found out that on average they were having 10 times as many conversations per visit. Okay, that's a lot. It's an order of magnitude more, you know, making those kind of connections again that we've been lacking. And I think that's one reason that people like going to the farmer's market, you know, because it begins to rebuild that kind of web. It shouldn't be any great surprise that we, I mean, we think of the farmer's market as this wonderful new thing that we've invented. But in fact, the farmer's market's how everybody on Earth shopped for food for 10,000 years and 90% of the planet still does. You know, the aberration was the giant supermarket on the edge of town. It's no wonder that we like that. We're built for that. And it's good that we're getting back to it. And we can do it across a wide range of commodities, not just food.
Does the groundswell need to come from consumers, or can businesses sort of get together and initiate this so that more people turn their eyes toward what's local?
Now, that's a good question. And across the country, there have been these sort of expanding networks of businesses really focusing on localness. There's something called the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, BALE, which has been very effective in building networks in 75 or 100 American towns and cities now. Some of them quite amazing to the degree that they've localized many, many functions in a town. And I think that that's only going to accelerate in business communities as we go through these economic hard times, when people are, when businesses are forced to rethink how they're going to survive. Well, the easiest way to do that is to figure out how you fit in with those closest around you, you know. So businesses have a role to play. Consumers have sort of driven this to some extent or another. The kind of demand for local food and things has been in many ways bottom up. Government has a role to play too. I mean, the thing that underwrote the globalization that we've seen, the sprawl that we've seen, has been the endless access to cheap fossil fuel. That's got to come to an end, if for no other reason than it's destroying the planet's climate. That's what all these discussions about cap and trade bills and things are that are now underway in Washington and around the globe. That has to come to, the minute that we set a price on carbon that reflects the damage that it does in the environment, then much of the impetus for that globalization will cease. And it'll become not only more sensible in a community way and in a culinary way, say, to eat close to home, it'll become completely sensible economically too, because you won't be able to rely on that super cheap energy to underwrite the agriculture that we have.
And what's happened, you've written, is that a lot of sort of big mega chains allow us to shield ourselves from the true cost of whatever it is we're consuming.
Absolutely. And it's what economists call externalities, okay? All the costs that go with whatever you're doing. In the case of environmental things, we've allowed them just to pretend that they didn't exist. Well, the bill's coming due for that, and it's an enormously big bill. You change the world so that you get a stronger set of hurricanes off the Gulf, right? And all of a sudden, post-Katrina, you're left with a $130 billion cleanup bill. Even in these days when we toss around hundreds of billions of dollars with some abandon, it's still a lot of money. And they multiply it by 1,000 as we go forward. We can't afford that. We're going to have to hunker down. We're going to have to become more self-sufficient and more self-reliant. And as we do, I think that we'll be better off in many ways, including psychological ones. What's interesting about the local economy is that it's neither liberal nor conservative. I mean, it's hard to look at a farmer's market and figure out whether it's a liberal thing or a conservative thing. It's all about supporting your neighbors, about being close to home, things that we traditionally think of as conservative values, And so I think this is the most interesting direction that we're going to be going in the years ahead.
So food is one thing. I think everyone can understand how that economy works and that it is better for the environment to get a tomato from 5 miles away than 5,000. But there are other choices we have to make economically as well. There's a great locally owned hardware store in my neighborhood. And if I go there to buy a screwdriver, it's probably still crafted somewhere very far away. Is it really that different if the owner is local and the products come from everywhere?
Well, that's a good question. And of course, there are some things that it's going to be a long time before we're making our own computers in every community or whatever. There are things we're always going to buy from a distance. In that case, what you want to think about is supporting the rich network of local businesses keeping money closer to home, you know? So if you go to Walmart, the money is as if you've just put it in a pneumatic tube and it gets sucked back to Arkansas and that's that. You know? If you spend it at the local store, it'll recirculate a couple of times in the community. Not only that, those businesses will support local services, okay? There's a tremendous correlation between, say, the advent of big box stores like Walmart in a community and the disappearance of local newspapers because they don't provide the advertising support that the local hardware stores and things used to. You know, they don't need local accountants to do their books, you know, don't need local lawyers to handle their cases, on and on and on. That kind of rich matrix of local businesses is what built economies in this country to begin with, and trying to figure out how to keep it going or to renew it is a great and interesting challenge.
And how do we influence the local businesses that we use if we want them to, you know, use more energy efficient fixtures in the store and do certain things? How much influence do we have on them?
I think you have a lot, and because they're your neighbors, you can talk to them. It's a lot easier to talk to them than it is to, I don't know who you know at Best Buy or something. I don't know how you go about talking. You know, everybody's there has worked there for 3 months and they're on. You know, with your local community, you have some real chance of influencing how people behave.
Do you think, Bill, today that the majority of Americans understand the gravity of the situation we are in environmentally?
No. And we've got to change that. I spend a lot of my time thinking and writing about these local things. I spend most of my time now, volunteer though, organizing on a very global scale. I wrote the first book about climate change 20 years ago, The End of Nature. And in the last few years, I've become mildly obsessive about sort of organizing to finally make something happen. 2 years ago, with a bunch of college kids, set up this thing called Step It Up that organized 1,400 demonstrations around the country on the same day and dramatically changed both Clinton and Obama's energy policies. The fruits of some of that work we're seeing now. Now we're at work on a global version of the same, something called 350.org. The number comes from what the scientists in the last year, the NASA scientists who are our best students of this phenomenon, have told us is the most carbon that we can safely have in the atmosphere, 350 parts per million. It's an arcane number, but it's the most important number in the world. As one of them said in the abstract of a scientific paper, any number higher than this is not compatible with the planet upon which civilization developed and to which life on Earth is adapted. And the trouble is, we're already past it. We're at 387 parts per million. That's why the Arctic is melting. That's why we're seeing unprecedented drought in arid areas and flooding in wet areas. That's why sea levels are beginning to rise. That's why very soon we need national and international policy that really makes a change, and that's what we're working towards at 350.org.
So what we're not going to be able to do is turn it around completely.
No. No one's going to stop global warming, which is, we can slow it down and maybe we can keep it from becoming utterly catastrophic, but there are going to be impacts. And that's another reason why local communities and economies make so much sense. We're much less vulnerable if we shorten our supply lines some, if we're more self-sufficient and self-reliant. You know, these are very important changes that we're going to be undergoing, and we need to be making changes in response. So you can see, I sort of spend a lot of time back and forth at the most global level and at the most local level, and I think those are in certain ways the most important, two most important levels we've got to work at now.
Environmentalist and writer Bill McKibben is my guest. He's in town for the EPA's National Sustainable Communities Conference. We'll be back in a moment, and you can join us at 1-800-933-5372. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Bill McKibben is my guest. He's a writer and environmentalist. His books include Deep Economy, The End of Nature, Maybe One, and The Bill McKibben Reader. He's in town to speak to the EPA's National Sustainable Communities Training Conference. If you want to be part of our conversation, you can give us a call at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Do you agree, maybe on a different sort of focus, with Rahm Emanuel's assessment that a crisis is a terrible thing to waste? I know he wasn't talking about the environment specifically.
Well, in a sense he was, I think, because the Obama administration so far seems to have made the necessary connection between getting out of our environmental pickle and our economic one. And they really are deeply linked. We can't – the only sort of growth strategy that people can foresee, I think, is one that relies on the rapid spread of green energy. There's nothing else, that, not information technology, not biotech, that's big enough to drive our economy in the years going forward. Rewiring America and the world for sustainable energy use is big enough. And so I think it's no accident that the Obama people have been trying to push the stimulus money in the direction, in many cases, of that green energy future. And I think it's very smart.
Where do you stand on this question of whether or not we should focus our efforts on improving technology so that all the things that we use require less energy, or deciding that we don't need to use quite as many things?
They're both essential. And the way you get at them, okay, is by changing the price of energy. And then letting markets do what markets do best. Okay? The role for government is to set a cap on the amount of carbon going into the atmosphere, to finally listen to the scientists who have been screaming about this for two decades now and set a serious cap on carbon. That would have the effect of making fossil fuel more expensive. We'd pay more at the pump. Now, you can rebate that money to people in effective ways so that they don't get so that they don't be bankrupted by that change. You don't need to have Congress spending all that money building new green technology. If you get the price right, markets will do it. Okay, right now they have no incentive. You know, T. Boone Pickens wants to build 3,000 more megawatts of wind power in Texas, but there's no investors for it at the moment because the price of fossil fuel has dropped so far again. We've got to change that. We can't burn all the coal that we have in this world, or even most of it, without causing grievous climatic disruption. So we desperately need, as a first step, that change in the price of carbon. And once that happens, these new technologies will spread and new habits will spread. When the price of gasoline went to $4 a gallon last year, for the first time since we invented the car, Americans started driving less. That was a good thing, not a bad one. And we need to have that continue. The public transit paper story in the paper today, public transit ridership around America is at a 52-year high all of a sudden. That's good news. You know, we need to figure out how to live much more like people in Western Europe do, where they use half as much energy per person and yet have perfectly nice lifestyles. I mean, in fact, you know, given the choice, more people would choose to go on their honeymoon to Paris than to Dallas, perhaps. You know, it's a beautiful place.
I don't know about that.
I don't know about that. Maybe not. Maybe the honeymoon trade is booming here. But its quality of life is fine, despite it, maybe in part because of its reduced energy use, you know. And all of that will happen more or less automatically if we get the price right.
Is it possible to create political will for that, though, in a time when, you know, we're losing literally hundreds of thousands of jobs every month?
We will see. Mm-hmm. That's the challenge of this year, and it has to happen soon. There's the huge international conference on global warming in Copenhagen in December that's supposed to come up with a successor to the Kyoto Treaty. If it fails, then what the science is telling us now is that we may have missed the last plausible bite at the apple in terms of really reorienting our trajectory. The climate science for the last 2 years has gotten steadily darker, and what looked like a very big problem now looks like an absolute emergency that has to be solved immediately if we're ever to get a hold of it.
Some of the objection to anything post-Kyoto or Kyoto itself is these questions of China and India. And what you've said is that basically the United States, one, needs to set the example, and two, needs to provide assistance for those countries on the scale of the Marshall Plan.
Yep, and which becomes, I think, the hardest thing in this economic trauma that we're entering. Okay, that they remain very poor countries, you know, China and India, though they're growing rapidly. And behind them, many other poor countries would like to grow rapidly and who have lots of coal. And we're going to have to share some of our technology with them, north to south, in such a way, just as the Marshall Plan was both noble and pragmatic simultaneously, we need to figure out the same thing here, because we can't solve this crisis alone. We'll need lots of help, and we'll need to reorient the whole world more in the direction of these localized, more self-sufficient economies.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Bill McKibben. He's in town for the EPA's National Sustainable Communities Training Conference. Let's speak to Reeves in Dallas. Hello, Reeves.
Yes, hi. On the local level here in University Park, I noticed all of my neighbors have lawn crews that use these leaf blowers and gasoline mowers, and it seems to me the carbon footprint, aside from the noise pollution, is incredible.
Well,
I'd like to know, what can we do to address that issue?
It's a good question, and it makes the perfect case for the kind of change that I'm talking about. Okay, it's going to be unbelievably difficult to go around America one town after another and fight the battle million upon million times about what the new zoning law for leaf blowers is going to be. Okay, I don't like leaf blowers myself. I live out in the woods. We just let the leaves fall where they may, as we say. Instead of fighting that battle a million times in a million communities, we need, and over a million other issues, you know, what kind of light bulbs to put in, or what kind of cars to drive, or whatever else. If we're able to change the price of fossil fuel in a serious way, then all those other changes will follow automatically. And you may well, the local lawn crew may well find that all of a sudden it makes a lot of sense to use that quite sophisticated and useful technology, the rake, once more, you know. Hopefully that's the direction we'll go in. That's why we're doing at 350.org this huge global day of action in October. There will be people in thousands of communities around the world simultaneously doing all the things they can think of to take this most important number on the planet and spread it. We'll have people high up in the Himalayas, you know, climbers. We'll have 350 scuba divers on the Great Barrier Reef. We just found out there'll be a team of people who are going to be on Easter Island that day, the kind of poster child for what happens if you don't take the environment seriously. And if we're able to focus attention on that number, if we're able to set the bar for what our climate negotiators need to do in Copenhagen, then there's a chance that in the next year or two, we'll finally, for the first time, see real change in the price of energy. And if that happens, then we're maybe be on the long-term track to dealing with a lot of these questions. So if you want to do something to help that's going to be effective more than in your neighborhood, and there's just, you can't make the math work one neighborhood at a time on global warming, then join that effort and ally your, you know, quite correct outrage about some of the ways in which we use energy with a strategy that has some hope of doing good on a large enough scale to matter.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Bill in Dallas. He asks, what is the carrying capacity of the Earth in terms of population size?
Well, that's it. Difficult question. And, of course, the answer depends in large measure on what you're carrying, i.e., the carrying capacity for Americans living middle-class American lives is different than the carrying capacity for, say, Indians living normal Indian lives. The average American family uses more energy between the stroke of midnight on New Year's Eve and dinner on January 2nd than the average African family uses in the course of a year. Okay, so the carrying capacity for those is very, very different. You could have a lot more Tanzanians living at that level than you could Americans because they use much less. Population is the one place where we've made substantial progress in recent years. Fertility levels for women around the world have dropped remarkably. Even if you lay aside China and its mandatory policies, 30 years ago, the average woman on this earth had 6 children. That number is now about 2.7 and continuing to drop. We're still going to add more people to the planet because there's a kind of momentum, demographic momentum. There's a lot of people coming into their childbearing years. But at least for global warming, it's less population that's driving this surge than it is consumption, than it is rapid growth in how much everybody consumes. And that's where carrying capacity really pinches. If we learned a whole different set of habits, you know, if we didn't, if we all took mass transit, if we ate, you know, small amounts of meat the way that most cuisines around the world eat instead of big honking slabs of meat, if, you know, those sort of things, our carrying capacity would be different. And those are the kind of things that'll change if we're able to get the price of energy right, because it's that cheap energy that's underwritten all the other habits that we've fallen into.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Plano and speak with Steve. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Yes, I'm curious if there's any research going on for more radical solutions. For instance, Kunstler wrote the book The Long Emergency, and he's written a novel recently, A World Made by Hand, where there's a mass migration from urban areas, and I was curious if there's any research going on where some kind of planning could be done for small, sustainable communities that don't rely on the grid.
Yeah, there are people looking hard at scenarios like that because they're not entirely fanciful. We're so vulnerable to the fact that we're running out of oil, and we're so vulnerable to some of the climatic disruptions that are beginning to plague us that, you know, I mean, it's no accident that books like Collapse, Jared Diamond's book and things have sold so well, or Jimmy Kunstler's books. People who are thinking about it tend to be online. The Post-Carbon Institute, for instance, is an example. And there's a lot of communities that are doing that kind of planning. The most interesting planning, I think, is exactly about these building up of local economies, not the planning for how I myself am going to survive. That generally just, you know, breaks down eventually into going down in the basement and oiling your guns, you know.
We've had enough of that.
Yeah. Much more interesting to figure out how communities are going to survive and even thrive in certain ways in the world that's coming. And that's what much of my work's about. I think it's an extremely interesting question, and I think it's going to require much more change than we quite understand. But it can, if we get going on it, happen somewhat evolutionarily. Let's hope.
The other thing that fascinates me about what you do for a living is, Bill, the idea that you want to communicate with people who might not have heard this message before or might not have absorbed it. You want to sort of sufficiently frighten them about the possibilities without turning them off and making them think, well, I might as well just fiddle while Rome burns because it's going to go down anyway.
It is a very strange mix, and I don't hit it right all the time. If I have any advantage, it's that, you know, having written the first book about global warming so long ago, I've had a certain amount of time to work through my own angst and all of that about this. And I remain scared, but at a certain level, it's okay. I understand more or less what's going to happen, and now let's figure out how to deal with it.
Sort of related question here from Leonard says, how do we get people to hear this message, especially in a time when we are at record levels of unemployment? People are going to look for the least expensive products and services. What's the balance between prosperity and environmental responsibility?
Well, I think that that in the sort of old world that we've been living in, that's a very good question, and with all the sort of old assumptions. I think in the world we're moving into, whatever kind of prosperity we're going to produce is going to be directly related to how carefully we manage to deal with these issues. You know, the International Energy Administration that looks at a very conservative group that looks at energy production around the world released its new forecast in November, right around the time of our election, so it didn't get so much notice. But what they found was that production at the world's oil fields will decline about 9% a year going forward. All the big oil fields that we know about, the Mideast and Venezuela and we're in the Gulf, wherever, on average. Well, that means that just to keep things going the way that they're going, you know, the way we live at the moment, never mind China and India driving cars, whatever, we'd need to find about four new Saudi Arabias by 2030. We're not going to do it. Plan A isn't any longer one of the possibilities. There are a series of plan Bs, and the very heartening thing about Obama, I think, is that he at least senses that possibility. At least we're past the utter and complete denial that marked the last 8 years, and that gives us some possibilities, you know, which is not to say that the pressures won't be extremely strong on him to just try to revive the old economy and call it a day. That is where the pressure will come, because there's still people making huge profits from the old energy business. But the future is, you know, we better get to it fast or we're not going to get to it.
Author and environmentalist Bill McKibben is my guest. His books include Deep Economy and The End of Nature and The Bill McKibben Reader. We'll return in just a moment to more of the conversation. If you'd like to be part of it, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Writer and environmentalist Bill McKibben is in town for the EPA's National Sustainable Communities Training Conference. He's here with us today. And if you would like to join the conversation, you can send an email to think@kera.org. I want to talk just a minute about this EPA initiative, because Dallas is one of the pilot cities for this Sustainable Skies initiative. One of the key components is central city livability. Can you talk a little bit about what makes a city livable in its core, and maybe talk about some of the urban regions that are, in fact, meeting those criteria right now?
Yeah, well, I mean, you can begin it the other way around and talk about what makes a city unlivable mm-hmm. in its core. And one of the first things that makes it unlivable is when nobody's living there, you know, when it's become a ghost town that everybody leaves at 5, you know, and maybe comes down for basketball game, and that's it. And figuring out how to build in the mix of uses that draw people back in is really important. And it's happening in all kinds of places. You know, you can find cities all over the country that have done a good job of making their downtowns attractive to all kinds of people across a wide socioeconomic mix. You need things to make that happen. You need decent transit. You know, you need affordable housing of all kinds. Often one of the best ways to jumpstart the renaissance of a city is to figure out a way to get artists back into downtown. Go look at all the old loft space that you have or whatever and convert it into, and pretty soon it's cool and hip and there's all kinds of people moving back in. Our model, where people just spun centrifugally out into the suburbs, turns out to be the worst possible idea, at least from an environmental standpoint, and as I say, I think also from a kind of psychological standpoint. The hyper-individualism that it bred in us is a big deficit that we have to overcome. To really see what the alternative looks like, you know, all you have to do is travel to Western Europe and, you know, and to see cities that are evolving very quickly, ever more in the right direction. You go to Copenhagen now and it's turned into a bicycle city. It looks like those pictures that you used to see of China, you know, which is busy going the other direction all of a sudden, for some reason copying Dallas or Phoenix or Los Angeles instead of copying Copenhagen or Amsterdam or Oslo or Paris. Paris last year launched this program of bike sharing. Okay, all there's 2,500 stands across the city, each one with 10 or 20 bicycles in them. They're never more than about 500 feet apart. You go and put a franc or two or a euro or something in the stand. You get a bike. You drive it as far as you want it. Find the next stand. Leave it. You get your money back. It's transformed the way that people live there. It's fantastic. These are the kind of ideas that we need quickly to hop on. And the cities that do will be the ones that really prosper because they'll attract the kind of people who are going to build the businesses and things of the future.
Can you talk for a minute, in places like that where people are on foot or on bicycles, does that change a lot when the weather's bad? Because, you know, in this part of the country, people say, well, I would do that, but it's just too hot. And I would imagine in Copenhagen, there are days when they might say, well, it's too cold.
It's too cold or it's too wet or it's, you know, people get a little tougher, you know, maybe or something. Mm-hmm. And, of course, people begin to design for that in mind. So if you go into an office building in Copenhagen, chances are that there's a shower someplace there for when people arrive. If they've been bicycling a long ways, they can take a shower. The office that I work in Middlebury College in Vermont was just redesigned. The Leeds Platinum building, the first Leeds Platinum environmental restoration renovation in the country, and one of the things they did was put in a shower, and I've noticed that all of a sudden there's a lot more people riding their bikes to work.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Peruse in Dallas. Hi, Peruse.
Hello, good afternoon. I have a question from your guest. If it's possible we make enough energy, I mean as electricity, without zero heat, zero CO2, and you think it's going to fix that problem and save our planet?
Well, that's the $64 question, Peruse. Look, I don't think we're going to ever have energy in the quantities that we've had it in the past. We've had our magic fuel. Coal and gas and oil were good stuff, easy to get at, rich in BTUs, easy to transport. It's too bad that they're wrecking the planet and that we're running out of the best of them, oil. You know, what follows won't be as easy. You know, renewable energy, by definition, is more diffuse and scattered than the very concentrated little deposits of ancient biology that we've been relying on. There's no one silver bullet. There may be enough silver buckshot lying around that if we pick it all up, we'll be able to patch together a sort of useful energy network. But job one is using a lot less. Conservation and efficiency is by far the cheapest way to go about things. And here America has a kind of ironic advantage over the rest of the world. We're such energy wastrels that the first 20 or 30%, whatever, almost is going to come for free. You know, it's like losing weight by getting a haircut. You know, it's not going to be enormously difficult at first because it'll mean okay, we don't have to drive semi-military vehicles anymore. You know, we can drive normal vehicles again, stop pretending that we're forest rangers or whatever we've been doing for the last 20 years, you know. We can change our light bulbs. We can, you know, not keep our house at you know, 62 degrees all summer long, all the things that we've fallen into. After that, it gets harder because you need to make more structural change. And there's no saying that this is going to be easy. It isn't. The changes that are, fossil fuel has been at the absolute center of our economy. And if we're going to be serious about getting off of it, it's going to mean changing all kinds of parts of that economy.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. John is on the line next in Arlington. Hi, John.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Okay. What I was wondering about is the state of the Holocaust deniers. I have a friend who is a meteorologist, and he says, no, there's no global warming. And I hear a lot of conservative voices who sort of poo-poo global warming. Are there high-level scientists who are not on board with global warming? And what is the view among the global warming supporting scientists about them, and could you briefly discuss some of the talking points that the deniers might use?
Sure. Good question. In the scientific community, among climatologists, among people doing peer-reviewed research on the Earth's climate, okay, there's no longer any significant dispute. That doesn't mean that your local weatherman or whatever may not be on board with the project, okay? But in terms of people doing peer-reviewed science about this, it's no longer a controversial topic. The Earth is warming. Human beings are the cause. That doesn't mean it's going to be easy to get everybody to accept that, because it runs counter to, you know, so many interests and so many things that we'd like to be able to believe. I've spent 20 years hoping, praying, I'm a, you know, Methodist Sunday school teacher, that I was going to be wrong about climate change.
Really? Even when you were writing the first book, did
absolutely.
You think to yourself, maybe I'm wrong?
I didn't think to myself, maybe I was wrong, but I sure hoped I was, mm-hmm. and continue to hope that I am, because it's the worst thing that's ever happened, and it's going to cause unbelievable amounts of pain and grief for unbelievable numbers of people, not to mention a lot of other species along the way. Okay. Most Americans now understand that it's real and coming at us. Okay, the polling data is pretty clear. We're never going to convince Rush Limbaugh, partly because he's an idiot and partly because he's not convincible. You know, the syllogism in I think in his head runs like this. Markets solve all problems. Markets aren't solving global warming. Therefore, global warming's not a problem. Okay, it's not a very good syllogism.
Wouldn't pass the SAT, maybe.
And it's not very good economics either, because as I've pointed out, we desperately need markets to solve it, global warming. They can't do it until we give them information to work with, the price signal contained in political action. It needs some government action. It needs some market action. It needs action of all kinds and fast.
You know, you mentioned your faith, and it's occurred to me in the past that there's almost a sort of Garden of Eden parable at work here, in that we've had our time when everything was easy and fuel was sort of there for the taking, and we didn't have to think too much about it. But it looks like the garden is closing up.
Well, it looks like we may have eaten the wrong apple. On it, you know, it's very true. It's a very good analogy, because, you know, we're going to go back to earning more of our bread by the sweat of our brows, you know, than we have been in the last little while. We're going to have, you know, we have less than 1% of Americans on the farm now, for instance. I don't think that's going to last, because the huge agribusiness farming that we've built is entirely dependent on cheap oil. Take it away, and we'll need some more people back at work on the farm, which I don't think is going to be the end of the world. I mean, I live in rural America. That'll actually help us rebuild communities in lots of places.
Are there limits to localism when it comes to eating? We had a guest on the other day who talked about the fact that, you know, in Oregon State, they can grow more pears than the people of Oregon could ever eat, and that's good farmland, and people need to eat those pears in other places.
Yeah, there's some of that. And, you know, I live in Vermont. Coffee doesn't seem to be, you know, in the offing anytime soon. I mean, it'll take a certain amount of global warming to produce a coffee industry
God
in
help
Vermont,
us at that point.
You know, right? So, yeah, there's plenty of room to trade some things around. You know, humans always have. We like different tastes. But, I wrote a piece not long ago about living for an entire year only on the food that came out of my valley in Vermont, which is, you know, near the border, long winter, you know, on and on and on. Not the easiest place to do this. But in fact, it was an entirely delightful year, and I ate just fine. And clearly, I'm still here and healthy, you know. And in the course of doing it, met hundreds of people, dozens of people anyway, farmers, others around. I have a much stronger sense of where I live now, and I'm very grateful for that.
Does this issue need to be specifically added to school curricula?
It's funny, because we were talking about food. I think the most effective way to get people thinking about a lot of these things in school, especially when they're young, are these, and they're now beginning to spread pretty quickly across the country, these farm-to-cafeteria programs that let kids see where what they eat comes from. You know, that's pretty useful. There's a lot of schools that are putting windmills up, partly to make money for the local school district, partly so that kids will have some understanding of where their power actually comes from. Things like that are extremely useful and helpful.
You mentioned Rush Limbaugh earlier not getting it. I'm wondering if you think that lawmakers on the right and the left get it at this point.
I think that it's difficult for lawmakers because this change requires short-term pain for long-term gain, okay? And lawmakers in our society have become notorious for wanting just the opposite, you know?
They're living for 2 years or 6 years, whatever the term is.
They want to deliver goodies for 2 years, even if it means mortgaging the future of everybody who comes after us. And they've done it economically by piling up debts and entitlements that we can't afford. And they're doing it ecologically by digging us into a kind of ecological debt that we have no hope of paying off. That's why the advent of the Obama administration is at least a moment for some kind of hope. There's the sense again that there are serious people in charge, you know, that we're taking a somewhat adult view of the world for a little while. And, you know, heaven help the poor guy. I mean, he's been left with every possible problem that there could be and has to solve them all at once. And, you know, it's by no means going to be easy, and it may not even be doable. But it is nice to have some sense that there's somebody trying. And that combined with the fact that young people across America are becoming deeply engaged on these issues gives me a certain amount of hope.
How has your optimism changed over the past couple of decades?
I think I've stopped worrying about whether I'm optimistic or pessimistic at any given moment. I just get up and go to work on this stuff and organize, especially now that we're doing this big 350.org campaign. It's really a pleasure to work with the young people involved in it. That allows me, if not to be optimistic, at least to be happy along the way, the sense that we're at least going to give it a good fight. I was in D.C. last week, and there were 12,000 college kids gathered for this huge power shift gathering about climate change. That sent chills up my spine, you know, the sense that at least we're going to give it a fight.
Bill McKibben has written a dozen books, including Deep Economy. You can find him online at billmckibben.com, also 350.org. He's in town for the EPA's National Sustainable Communities Conference. Bill, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
It's been fun for me. Thank you, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.